You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we're only a few hours into the NCAA men's basketball tournament, so your bracket can't be busted too badly yet, or can it? We'll take a look at the return of March Madness coming up. Now, the president and vice president are in Georgia today. This is a planned stop on their national tour to promote parts of the American Rescue Plan for pandemic relief and economic recovery. But they changed plans to meet with Asian American leaders in Atlanta following shootings in the area earlier this week. The single white suspect has been charged with killing 8 people, including 6 women of Asian descent. 2 days ago, President Biden tweeted, "We don't yet know the motive, but what we do know is that the Asian American community is feeling enormous pain tonight. The recent attacks against the community are un-American. They must stop," end quote. Coming up Monday on the show, we'll talk to a UW historian about the history of violence against Asian Americans. Now we take a look at hate crime laws and when and how they're applied. There have been calls to charge this perpetrator and others who have targeted Asian Americans over the last year with hate crimes. Our next guest is a former prosecutor and an expert on hate crimes and what leads to the decision on whether or not to include those charges. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what is and isn't considered a hate crime and how they're investigated, prosecuted, and punished? And what thoughts do you have about hate crime laws in general? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Cami Chavis is Vice Provost, Professor of Law, and Director of the Criminal Justice Program at Wake Forest University. Cami, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's just start with the basics of what bias-motivated crimes are, I think is a technical term, or hate crime laws. What kind of legal definitions are out there?
Yes, it's really important because when we're talking about hate crimes, or also known as bias-motivated crimes, it's really important to understand that these are going to be statutorily defined crimes. So, and they exist at the state level and the federal level. I will say that most states in the United States have some type of legislation related to hate crimes. Up until this summer, Georgia was one of only 4 states that did not have a hate crimes law. So we do have that in Georgia now. However, there's the federal government does have one as well. When we're thinking about these bias motivated crimes, it's important to understand that a prosecutor is going to have to prove every element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. And one of those elements would be that the perpetrator targeted the victim. They participated in the behavior because of the victim's membership in one of the protected classes. Different statutes enumerate different classes. For example, many states will have race, ethnicity, gender. Some of them also include sexual orientation and gender identity. The federal hate crimes law encompasses all of those categories.
So what kind of evidence would a prosecutor be looking at to be able to make the case that, yes, in fact, this was a bias-motivated crime? What kind of signs, signals are needed there?
Yes. So it's very it's going to be circumstantial in some ways. Of course, if you are, when I say that, I mean it's going to be fact dependent. So there are a number of different behaviors or pieces of evidence. For example, if you are at the scene of a crime or if you have witnesses and you see that the person has uttered that the perpetrator has uttered some type of racial slur, or they admitted, they said, "I'm doing this because of your membership in this class. I'm doing this because you're black," or "I'm doing this because you're Asian." That would be the strongest piece of evidence. But you don't have to have that. You can also prosecutors will no doubt, as we think about what's unfolding in Atlanta, no doubt will be going through a suspect's social media, their online account, interviewing other associates witnesses to the crime, but associates to figure out, does this person harbor this type of animus? What do we know about this person that might demonstrate why they participated in this particular crime?
We're talking to Cami Chavis, a law professor at Wake Forest University, former federal prosecutor, about hate crimes laws after the shootings this week in Georgia. I want to give a listen to Atlanta Mayor Akeisha Lance Bottoms, who said publicly she thinks these shootings look like hate crimes. She spoke with CNN's David Axelrod about it. Here, he's just reinforced the suspected perpetrator's statement to law enforcement that he wasn't motivated by race. Acknowledging the motive as we know it so far isn't clear, though. Here's a listen to the Atlanta mayor.
It's not, but also keeping in mind that we're listening to a confessed murderer. So we, you know, have to take it all with a grain of salt. But we can't ignore the fact that there were Asian women who seemed to have been targeted, these Asian massage parlors.
So a couple of things there, Cami. First of all, a prosecutor looking at a suspect's statement that the suspect himself in this case saying this wasn't racially motivated. How does that stack up as evidence in possible hate crime cases?
Well, I think it's very much like what the mayor said. A lot of times these suspects will say, oh, I didn't do it, or I didn't do it because of this. It wouldn't be in his interest to admit that. Even if that were the case, we have, however, you know, in the past, we have seen a lot of suspects do just that. Dylan Roof is one that we can think of that readily admitted that the reason he walked into Mother Emanuel Church, it was to kill the black folks that were worshiping there. And so that only makes a prosecutor's job, that eases the burden, because there you have that piece of evidence, and then they can go and they can collect more. The fact that this person has said, oh, that's not why I did it, that's really not dispositive. That's not going to be determinative of whether or not it actually was motivated by bias. You would need to do more of an investigation that might uncover the real motive here.
At the same time, I think there could be cases that we look at and say, okay, this person clearly may have dehumanized in his mind his victims because they were women and they were Asian American. But is that in itself enough to raise hate crime charges if there aren't statements or the other behaviors you talked about from a suspect? So societally, people might agree it's a hate crime. Legally, the standard might not be met.
Yes, that's very true. And I think it's really important here to understand, the distinction, what we're talking about. There have been a number of bias motivated incidents. There's been an increase as of last year. We were at our biggest increase in the past 10 years for bias motivated crimes, and almost 57% of those related to race. And what we've seen is we have seen an increase in the number of bias-motivated crimes against Asians in this country. I think that is we have to recognize that the pandemic and the rhetoric around the pandemic has correlated with that increase, just like we saw an increase in bias-motivated crimes against Muslim Americans or folks who even just appeared to be Muslim Americans after 9/11. So and the community, when we were thinking about the type of violence and the context in which that violence happened, it is important. And it's important to note that many of our Asian American or Asians in the United States are feeling on edge anyway because of the increase in those instances. And now with this violence taking place, it's very scary for members of that community.
We're talking about some of the defining characteristics of hate crimes and how they're handled in the American legal system. Our guest is Cami Chavis from Wake Forest University, law professor, former federal prosecutor. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about hate crimes, what they are, how they're enforced? Do you think they're a good idea? Would you like to see them applied more? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Cami Chavis, professor of law and director of the criminal justice program at Wake Forest University, former federal prosecutor, looking at hate crimes, how laws work, how they are prosecuted. You could join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Cami, are hate crimes or bias-motivated crimes treated consistently across the United States from jurisdiction to jurisdiction?
No, not at all. There are a number of different states that have hate crimes legislation, and they differ wildly. This was, you know, there's just a patchwork of state laws. Some of the laws will, and these laws, and I should mention that most of them act as penalty enhancers. So, for example, if you commit an assault, maybe you'd normally receive something like 5 years, and then this would be a penalty enhancement and would be statutorily increased by a number of years, and that would be determined by the statute. But the laws really are very different. As I mentioned earlier, some of them some of them are more narrow than others, meaning that they may protect certain categories. You usually will see race, religion, ethnicity, and gender. But then others, they do not have a gender identity or sexual orientation as a protected category. And then but many of the laws also do not have any requirements about reporting, hate crimes laws in terms of being able to collect information. So it's very important that, therefore, that we have the federal law that it is broad. It does cover all those categories. And so if a state doesn't have a hate crimes provision, or if they have one but it doesn't cover, for example, gender identity, then the Matthew Shepard James Byrd Hate Crime Preventions Act that was signed into law by President Obama in 2009 can work to fill that, and that's when the federal government can come in and prosecute.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Lynn is with us in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call in. I feel that hate crimes have they've been given permission over the last few years to say it's all right to do them. And this is wrong. That's why it has increased. And I just feel like they need to be prosecuted and they need to be hit hard. That's my two cents worth.
Lynn, thanks for the call. Is there a thought that prosecuting hate crimes as hate crimes might have a deterrent effect or send kind of a message, as it sounds like Lynn is hoping would happen, Cami?
Yeah. So, you know, the underlying rationale, the reason why we have these laws in the first place, or the reason that the federal law, which actually was expanded in 2009, the law that I mentioned. But the original law was an outgrowth of the 13th Amendment, you know, meant to rid us of the vestiges and badges of slavery. So we really go back to, a deep racial divide in our country. And these laws, again, the origin is to say, it is not okay to engage in any type of violence, but we also think it is symbolic that we don't want anyone targeted because of their membership in one of these protected classes.
And Cammie, that reminds me, thanks for bringing up the history. My limited understanding of the origins of these kind of laws has to do with, if someone, say, was attacked and or killed for registering black voters in the South, say, it isn't just a crime against them. The hate crime would also be the message that other people shouldn't be trying to vote or enroll voters. It's partly the effect on the victim, of course, but also the wider impact on the targeted group. Is part of the motivation behind the hate crime rule?
Yes, absolutely. So when I should also just mention that again, prior to 2009, the federal law, for example, it had a narrow class of protected categories like race and ethnicity, religion, and the victim had to be engaging in one of these federally protected activities like voting or housing or going to school, one of those things. And so in 2009, when that law was expanded, we no longer have that jurisdictional limitation. If you can prove that a person was targeted, by violence because of their membership in one of these classes, that is enough. But the reason for that is, just as you've stated, when this happens, it happens not only to the victim, but that the entire targeted community, it spreads fear. And if you think back to like Reconstruction and all of that, and that's exactly what we had. Domestic terrorists were what they were, the Ku Klux Klan, KKK, and other groups, and they tried to dominate and instill fear in Black Americans because of their race, and so doing something to one member of the community was a message to everyone else. And so that's what, when we think about the symbolism of these laws, that is what they are meant to deter. Everyone, no matter who you are, no one deserves to be targeted because of their race, ethnicity, gender identity, sexual orientation, if we're talking about the federal law.
We're talking about hate crime laws with Cammie Chavis, a former federal prosecutor, now at Wake Forest University's Law School. Back to your calls now. Heather is with us in Madison. Heather, hello.
Hey, I am just kind of distressed by what I hear in this discussion as the entire focus on this one man and this one action. And we're talking about a sex industry that, by and large, is targeting vulnerable women, often minorities. I'd like to see some statistics and information on how many women engaged in the sex trade in Atlanta happen to be of Asian descent. And why aren't we discussing that issue, the fact that these women are being forced into the sex trade by and large? And that's a hate crime. That is targeting people because of their vulnerability, often because of their ethnic background, terrorizing people into being forced into to an illegal sex trade. And we're not talking about that.
Thanks a lot for the call. I think a lot of people are talking about it, and it's not clear that all the victims were involved in the sex trade, Cammie. But to Heather's point, if a particular group of people is vulnerable and exploited in a crime like sex trafficking, does that fall under hate crimes?
Well, yeah, and I think it's really, really important. I know that there have been, varying reports here or there, but as far as I know, there's no indication that any of these particular women, and in fact, we do know that at least a couple of the people that were shot were there visiting. All right, so I don't think it's even fair to the victims to also insinuate that they may have been involved in that. In that trade, although the caller brings up a very good point, in that we do know that that there are many victims in human trafficking, and that is another issue that we have, I think, fully yet to grapple with within our country, is sex trafficking and human trafficking that happens within our own borders. But again, you would have to, would it be gender? Would you be able to say that, you know, a crime has happened because of someone's gender? We also know that there are, perhaps not in this context, but there are many victims of human trafficking that are not women. So I think that is probably it is a different issue, but also a very important one to tackle.
In our last minute or so, Cammie, what are you watching for with these this case in Georgia, these horrible shootings, and whether or not they'll be investigated and or prosecuted as hate crimes?
Yes, I have to say that I was very disappointed for the captain who initially came out and said, "Oh, this is just a person, and he had a bad day, and it's not a hate crime." And then you also had the FBI director who was more measured in his comments, but also said that. And I think that that given the context, it should be investigated as a possible hate crime. There's no indication that it should not. It should be investigated that way. And if the facts don't bear out, then they don't bear out, and the person he would not be able to be charged in that manner. But I think that one thing we need to do when I think about hate crimes is we really need a lot more education. I gave some statistics at the beginning of our conversation, and hate crimes in our country are really underreported. They're underreported, and they are underinvestigated, and they are underenforced. And I think that is particularly true. There's some cultural barriers and things with the Asian American community, and them, you know, feeling that they have not had justice, that they are invisible victims. And I think that even the increase we've seen in bias motivated crimes against that community are still even underreported as they are in other groups. So we need more education for our law enforcement officials about looking for the signs that this may be a bias motivated crime. And again, the comments of the sheriff's from the sheriff's office that initially came out, I thought were very premature and really kind of, you know, indicated that there needed to be some more.
We'll have to leave it there. That's Cammie Chavis from Wake Forest University. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin has a lower minimum wage for workers who receive tips. A state lawmaker joins the show to make the case that we ought to change that. Now, it's one of the best times of the year to be a sports fan, especially considering it was canceled because of the pandemic last year. The NCAA men's basketball tournament technically tipped off yesterday with 4 play-in games, but today is the first full day of action. Already there's been a shocking upset with a 15 seed, Oral Roberts, taking down the number 2 seed, The Ohio State University, in overtime. Tonight in Indianapolis, the 9th seeded Wisconsin Badgers take on the number 8 seed, North Carolina Tar Heels. It'll be just the 4th meeting between the two schools. So as you look over your brackets, our next guest says hopefully you didn't listen to him too much. Jason Gay is a sports columnist at the Wall Street Journal and the author of Little Victories, a sports writer's notes on winning at life. He's also a UW-Madison alum. I talked to him earlier today. Jason, welcome back.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Well, if I'm reading you right, I mean, you're a professional sports writer, Jason. You are feeling rock solid confident in your bracket this year, right?
The only thing I'm certain of is that my bracket, by the time anyone is listening to this, will have been so busted, they will be sending it to the Museum of Radio and Television as an example of one of the worst all-time brackets in college basketball history.
Now, we didn't get to do this last year. I mean, is it exciting for you to have this big sports event back on the table? Changed, of course, for COVID reasons.
Of course. And, you know, it's hard to think of a ritual of you know, winter turning to spring that's more beloved than March Madness. I mean, it really, you know, get people energized. It's obviously a strange environment still, right? You know, we're by no means out of this pandemic. A lot of people aren't in the kind of office settings where, you know, you'd have somebody printing it out and handing you a copy and doing the office pool and all that stuff. But we're getting all a little better virtual. You know, we're getting a little bit more adept at communicating with each other. So I think there's interest. But yeah, you know, I'm really happy to see it back, but I think anybody involved with it, whether it's a player, coach, school, mascot, it's a different thing this year.
Do you have a strategy behind your picks for a bracket?
Yes, I go completely on gut instinct, nostalgia, and emotion, which are three things you should never use while filling out your bracket. I have to go that way, though. The people who are sitting there, you know, looking at the analytic ratings and thinking it so coldly, to me, that's not what college sports are about. And, you know, I understand people are trying to win these things. For me, like, you know, there's no way I'm going to, you know, pick the Badgers to do anything less than march all the way to the Final Four, even if it makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, and Wisconsin actually starts off tonight with not a shoe-in win. What are you thinking as you watch them against North Carolina?
Well, this is a game like, you know, in another year might be a fantastic final, right? You know, two heavyweight programs, you know, the storied Tar Heels going up against the Badgers. It's a heck of a first round or an opening round matchup. But I'm a little worried that either one of them is going to end up being a light snack for Baylor in the next round, because Baylor is a juggernaut this year, and they're going to be an awfully tough opponent for whoever gets through the Carolina-Wisconsin game.
Talking to Jason Gay, sports columnist with the Wall Street Journal, looking at March Madness brackets and more. Jason, again, it's your gut driving you here. Who does your gut say is going to the Final Four this year?
Well, I think, you know, I'm not going to tell anybody who's been following the game closely something that they don't know, but Gonzaga has been an incredible program this year. They are historically sensational. This is not a team that is merely undefeated walking into this tournament. This is a team that has been dominating its opponents in a way that, you know, you really have to go back in college basketball history to find comparably dominant programs. They're going to be hard to beat. Obviously, this would be a remarkable accomplishment for that program, which has long been after this. I would love to see, you know, some sort of ripple where you see a team like a St. Bonaventure or some sort of Cinderella get in there. I mean, you think about the last 12 months that we've had since this tournament got canceled. It's been all about, you know, strange disruptions and surprises. And wouldn't it be characteristic of what this last year has been like, were we to see a couple of programs who you just ordinarily wouldn't assume would make it? That would make it, I think, a special tournament.
I know you are rooting for one particular Midwestern team, Wisconsin, of course. You have worries about another Midwestern team going further than you want. What's Michigan looking like?
Okay, so you're referring, of course, to the Michigan Wolverines, a program that dare not speak its name typically in my column because I'm surrounded at the Wall Street Journal by Wolverines. Wolverines to my right and left, even virtually, they're swarming my Zoom calls. But, you know, I don't have the type of animosity towards the basketball program that I might have toward a certain football team. I love Juwan Howard. I love the Fab Five. I love that era of Michigan basketball. It was something that fascinated me as a kid. I love them. They're great. I'm rooting for Juwan. They're obviously a talented team. They have some injury issues. We'll see how far they go. But I don't think it would shock anybody if they put together a run in this tournament. So, yeah. You know, I'm keeping my claws removed here a little bit because I do have a soft spot for Juwan Howard.
Can you just talk about the status of March Madness in our overall sports world? Because I'm a casual college basketball fan, but some of my most emotional memories are watching like Bronson Koenig, win games at the last minute a few years back. It really, I know, it's this vehicle for amazing moments.
It really is, and I think that there's nothing like it in the context of American sports, at least, where you have this, you know, single elimination tournament where you have programs coming from all across the country. It's got, you know, giant killers, Cinderellas. It has blue chip programs that you're used to seeing every year. You see stars, you know, minted over the course of a weekend. There's nothing quite like it. And the women's tournament is just as dynamite now as that sport continues to boom. I think that what makes it special for people is what you said, is that those kinds of moments and those buzzer beaters, but also just, you know, whenever you bring together just a series of passionate people where you can have kind of a running argument, right? You know, like college basketball is sort of, or college sports in general are kind of tribal, right? People get very excited and defensive of their, not just their program, but their conference and they're part of the country. And, you put that all together in this big stew for 3 or 4 weeks, and it's something pretty special. Again, this year, really different. They're putting the whole men's tournament in around the Indianapolis area. The women's tournament is down in San Antonio. It's a much, it's not a pure bubble, but it's a, certainly a much more confined experience. Not the same reverie that we're used to. But I think for thinking of where we were 12 months ago, I think a lot of people are happy to see it back.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you very much.
Jason Gay is a sports columnist with the Wall Street Journal, author of Little Victories, and a UW-Madison alum. We talked to him about the NCAA Men's College Basketball Tournament. Today is the first full day of action. The ninth-seeded Badgers take on the eighth-seed North Carolina Tar Heels tonight. The winner plays the top-seeded Baylor Bears on Sunday. Coming up, we'll talk to a state representative and restaurant owner about her proposal to get rid of Wisconsin's lower minimum wage for tipped workers. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's the weekly news roundup, including a look at the Biden administration's policy toward Russia. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, newly proposed legislation would get rid of Wisconsin's lower minimum wage for tipped workers. That wage currently stands at $2.33 an hour. The proposal from two Democratic lawmakers would bring tipped workers up to the state's minimum wage of $7.25. One of the authors of the bill joins us now to talk about the idea. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you currently in a work that counts on tips? What's that experience been like? Would raising that to at least the state's regular minimum wage make a difference for you? If you are, say, a restaurant owner, what do you think about the idea? Have you done something similar in your business anyway? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Francesca Hong is a Democrat representing the state's 76th Assembly District in Madison. Representative Hong, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Can you tell us a little more about the proposal that you and Senator Chris Larson of Milwaukee are putting forward here?
Yes, I am very grateful to Senator Larson for introducing this legislation with me. It would repeal the current subminimum wage of $2.33 an hour for tipped employees and raise that to $7.25 an hour, which is the current state minimum wage.
Can you talk about the impact that the lower minimum wage has on tipped workers?
You know, it really is, it's not a livable wage. And what happens is it puts the worker in a position where they are at a disadvantage and vulnerable to the whim of the customer as well as their employer in terms of feeling empowered at work and having financial stability, and takes away the opportunity to be eligible for benefits. And in some cases for women and people of color, puts them in situations where they experience harassment and during, in times of like now during the pandemic, puts them in very vulnerable situations where they have to ask the customer to put a mask on times or help with the safety of their environment. And those types of interactions can impact their tip. And then so you're going home with less than minimum wage. And oftentimes employers are not held accountable for not meeting that minimum meeting at least the minimum wage of $7.25 that folks an hour that folks go home with.
And that's how it's supposed to work, right? The idea is if that employee didn't end up making effectively $7.25 an hour with the tips factored in, the employer is supposed to make that up. From what you've seen working in the restaurant industry, does it happen that way?
I mean, there are a lot of good faith employers and there's some bad actors. And I think what happens is, do employees have access to that information and are they educated in knowing that those are their rights? A lot of times it's kind of hard to keep track, especially when you have paychecks coming through and your tips aren't, you don't take them home at night. There's just a lot of room for, I think disingenuous kind of reporting and it can lead to wage theft. And we heard that from Larissa at the press conference the other day where, workers who don't know their rights, that that is the case, you know, especially if you may be undocumented and you don't want to report that, there's just not a lot of accountability around it. And I think having a set $7.25 minimum wage for tipped workers as well would help in terms of gaining a financial security for the employees, as well as just holding employers accountable.
For restaurant owners out there listening, maybe thinking this would be a good idea, but worried that, you know, it's going to be more cost for them, especially after a rough year with the pandemic. What would you say to them to sell them on this idea?
You know, as a restaurant owner myself, I have to say that we believe in empowering our workers, and we know that there can be some hesitancy around the financial cost around it, but there's also financial cost to high turnover. And we're in an industry that, you know, the labor market is tight right now, and we have to be competitive when it comes to acquiring labor and really look at holistically improving the conditions for our workers. We switched to a model where we offer all of our employees currently $15 an hour. We no longer have this division between the front of the house and back of the house. We've shared responsibilities because in the end goal is to provide a great experience for the customer, and everyone is working towards that same goal. So why not have a more stabilized equal pay structure and really look at how we can make our industry as a whole more equitable? So I would say you're saving in terms of turnover costs, because training costs are involved when you constantly have employees who are working in unstable conditions, not being able to make ends meet. And also, I think it really does help morale, and it helps build, you know, make our industry less of a part-time industry, and makes employees and workers more invested in the work that they're doing when they feel empowered and when they feel like they are being compensated properly for the work they're doing.
We're talking to Democratic State Assembly Representative Francesca Hong about the idea of ending the separate lower minimum wage for tipped employees. Think restaurant workers and other workers who rely on tips. You can join in if you have a thought or experience to share at 800-642-1234. Representative Hong, I understand we would not be the first state to do this. Seven, I think, California and Alaska are a couple, our neighbors in Minnesota. Have you looked at those states to see how this change worked out?
Yes, it has improved working conditions for employees. What it has done is customers feel good about where they go to eat, that there is transparency from the owners about how they treat their workers. I think right now, especially with the industry having been hard hit, you know, there's compassion and empathy from customers right now to go back to restaurants, but they also want to know what type of restaurant they're going to and how they're treating their workers, and knowing that it's not just about you know, that restaurants are working more collaboratively, restaurants are working to address equity issues. I think it's really going to make the dining experience for the customer better, and more importantly, the working conditions and the environment for the employees better.
This is going beyond your proposed legislation here. I've heard arguments that, hey, maybe why do we do tipping at all? Maybe we should get rid of that. Other countries don't rely so much on tips in their restaurants often. What do you think of the whole concept of tipping as our norm in the United States in restaurants?
Personally, I know that with the history of where tipping comes from, that it is kind of inherently built into a racist institution, that, you know, if you look at the hospitality industry and the history of it and how service workers came to be, it's a very vulnerable industry with low entry barriers. And so, you know, it because it's attracted to more vulnerable workers, there's actually more opportunity for abuse of workers. And I think with tipping, it puts the accountability on the customer as opposed to the employer. And we need more employers to be held accountable for creating good working conditions for their employees. And so I personally see tipping going away at some point. I know that it's something that we should be working towards more slowly, especially because, you know, with how restaurants are structured now, it's difficult when you have people working, you know, shorter hours, but making more, but it's still inequitable because you have, you know, higher end places where check averages are higher and servers may be taking home more, working less. versus the folks where there's, you know, a short lower check average, and they do have to make up for some of those tips if it's not there for the servers at the end of the night. I think the restaurant industry, there were a lot of disparities that opened up with the pandemic, and we're going to be looking at some fundamental changes of how we look at it, of how we treat the workers, and what front of the house and back of the house really means. But there's also a responsibility on the customer right now to understand that our food costs and costs of going out to eat have been artificially low for a very long time, because it's based on, if especially for restaurants that are committed to working with small farms using products locally as they should be. It's all connected to a food system that is somewhat broken in the country. So tipping in itself is connected to a lot. And I hope that collectively, both as restaurant workers, restaurant employers, customers, we all start thinking more holistically about how to strengthen the food systems, and that restaurants play a big role in that, and so does tipping. So I think we're going to see more service charges going in. I think you're going to see some automation come in, and we're going to have to grapple with some really tough issues. But where our focus is on the worker.
And for that consumer, that makes me think people might worry, well, wait, if you're going to change how you pay people, am I going to have to pay more at a restaurant? What would you say to them?
Yeah, I think that is probably what's going to happen, but it's important to put into the context that we've been paying artificially low for a very long time. And it's not just inflation that's coming to play here. We haven't moved the minimum wage in over 12 years. That low wage workers in the food industry is what keeps, the cost of what it is to go out to eat low. And we really have to think that a hospitality industry does want to center people at its core. So if we're wanting to be thinking holistically about going out to eat, it was artificially low before the cost of it. So, when you go out to eat now, especially locally, your money is going back into the local economy, because restaurants pay that out to so many different industries. Restaurants are tied directly to many other suppliers in the local economy, and really do act as the cornerstone for local economies.
What is the timeline now for introducing this legislation and trying to advance it in the Assembly?
Yeah, so it is currently in circulation, and once our co-sponsorship deadline is late next week, we're hoping that it will see committee, and then it will be on the speaker to assign it to a committee, and then hopefully we'll bring it to the floor.
And briefly, as we start to wrap up, while we've got you, are there other priorities you have for this year's legislative session?
We're looking now at certain statutes where I think we need to have a larger conversation about decriminalizing sex work. Our office is also focused on expanding affordable housing for folks in the state. And then climate justice. We know that this is an urgent matter. Across many offices in the state, legislation to make sure that there's clean water, as well as a focus on clean energy and green jobs, is what's really going to help us come out of this pandemic and build a stronger communication and economic infrastructure moving into the future here.
Representative Hong, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to State Assembly Representative Francesca Hong. She's a Democrat representing the state's 76th Assembly District in Madison. She joined us today to talk about a bill that she's proposing, along with State Senator Chris Larson of Milwaukee, that would eliminate the separate minimum wage, the lower minimum wage for tipped workers in the state, restaurants, and elsewhere. You can let us know what you think of that idea. Head over to Twitter. We are at Central Time WPR. Should the tipped minimum wage go away and just match the normal minimum wage? Again, tweet us at Central Time WPR. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday at 8, the Biden administration opened up a special enrollment period for health care coverage under the Affordable Care Act because of the long-term disruptions from the pandemic. Find out about signing up, how to sign up, subsidies available, and if this affects you. That's Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a behavioral scientist explains the appeal to nature fallacy, the idea that natural things are automatically better and safer than synthetic ones. And by the way, as we do every Friday, we open up our Food Friday conversation over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. We want to hear your maple syrup story. Do you tap syrup? Do you tap sap and make it into syrup, I should say, each and every year? Are you good at it? Have you been doing it a long time? Is it a family tradition for you? And what is your favorite way to consume maple syrup? Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can share some of your stories over the coming week. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.